Really wonderful weather report here for the Palouse and the larger region of the Clearwater Valley, so it should be great. Today's guest on the Wild Clearwater Country Show is going to be Sam Mace of Save Our Wild Salmon. She should be calling in here in a few minutes, and we should have a really interesting interview with her concerning salmon and steelhead, wild salmon and steelhead recovery in the Columbia and Snake River basins, and what is the vision of their group for recovery. And we're not talking about hatchery fish here. We're talking about the wild ones, the wild things. And so it should be a great interview. She should be calling here in a few minutes. Let's take a short music break. And you're listening to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. This is KRFP Moscow.
Imminent, turbulence inevitable. For it is the way of creation and perpetual balance, chaos in beauty. Awake now and carry the responsibilities of endlessness, messengers of timelessness. Infinity. The future of the past and the rebirth of the next world to be. May Earth's children heed the messengers, the ones who bring the voices of the past, for they are the voices of our ancestors who belong to the future and will welcome you around the fire of destiny, the fire without an end.
We'll be right back. the stars are asleep as a new day comes. Wipe up this room that never ends. And listen to the voice that the spirit sends.
And welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Joining us on the line today or on the program is Sam Mace, the Inland Northwest Project Director for the group Save Our Wild Salmon. Save Our Wild Salmon is a diverse nationwide coalition working together to restore wild salmon and steelhead to the Columbia and Snake River basins. Sam, how are you today?
I'm good. Doing great.
Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule and being a guest here on the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Certainly the topic of today's show is going to be about recovering wild, not hatchery, but wild salmon and steelhead fish populations in the Columbia and Snake River Basin, and exploring the vision of Save Our Wild Salmon and what that vision means. But before we jump into that, I thought we'd start off here for our listeners and getting a chance to learn how long has Save Our Wild Salmon been involved in the campaign to restore wild salmon and steelhead populations, and what type of groups and individuals make up the coalition?
Well, Save Our Wild Salmon Coalition just celebrated our 20th anniversary as a coalition, and we were formed in the early 90s, 91, 92, as all the different interests and folks who cared about salmon in the Northwest, from the commercial fishermen to the conservation groups to the sport fishing businesses and sport fishermen, just saw the runs plummeting. And, you know, of course, we had our salmon getting listed in the 90s as well on the Endangered Species Act. And prior, there'd been a lot of fighting over the last fish, people fighting over who got to catch the last fish, fighting over what we should do to try to restore these fish. And finally, people came together and said, hey, we're fighting over fish as they're disappearing. And while we may not agree on all the different restoration plans that need to happen to save these fish, we can all agree that the hydro system on the Columbia and Snake Rivers are taking about 80% of the fish. And the single best thing that we can do for our wild salmon, as well as our, frankly, our hatchery salmon, to be able to catch those, is to address those problems and address the impact the hydro system is having on our salmon populations. And so our coalition worked on that for a number of years, of basically trying to make the dams more fish-friendly, seeing where we could increase survival, seeing what we could do with the system in place, because it didn't look like any dam was going to be being removed anytime soon. But in the late 90s, as different additional studies were coming out from the scientists, economic and scientific reports were coming out of the federal agencies, including the Corps of Engineers, people really started to look again at those last four dams that had been built in the system, which had really been the death knell for, obviously, Snake River, Salmon, and Steelhead. And we endorsed in 1997 as a coalition removal of those four lower dams and committed as a campaign of businesses and conservation groups and interests to work to remove those four dams. So that's our history, and that's what we have been working on, both in the region and outreach and, you know, in the political realm as well as in the court since then.
Well, you mentioned the number, you put out the number 80% there. Would you reiterate or expand on that a little bit? Did you say that 80% of is it of the wild or just wild and hatchery fish combined, 80% of them don't get past all eight dams?
It depends on the year, and it depends on the species and stock of fish. But certainly there are some runs of fish that have in the past taken a real beating in the hydro system. And it's not just or not so much the adult salmon going upstream, it's those young smolts that are traveling downstream that used to, historically before the dams there, they could make the trip from Idaho, the streams they respond in, down to the ocean in a matter of a couple of weeks. And now with their whole journey on the main stem turned into lakes by these dams, it can take them, you know, months to make it down. And they're dealing with high temperatures, and they're dealing with more predator fish and all kinds of other impacts along the way that really does a number on the smolts.
Well, you know, that's something that I've certainly learned. I don't want to speak for the public at large here, but I think there, if the right word is to use a misperception, I think there's a misperception. It could be a misperception out there when we say, oh, that the dams is what's killing all the salmon and the steelhead. And so I think what you initially picture is those fish trying to swim upstream and not being able to get past them. But like you're saying, the actual bigger problem, and amazingly so, and I guess that has a lot to do with fish ladders, is that the smolts, the juveniles that are heading downstream, that's actually where more of the mortalities occur, and that's actually the larger problem.
Exactly, completely. That is the problem. And just to give you a perspective on what we've lost, because it's hard to, there's a lot of misinformation and there's a lot of different numbers that are thrown out there in terms of, you know, fish returns coming back and what the runs are like compared to historical numbers. Historically, in the entire basin before Western development, before the white people showed up, we had upwards of 30 million fish entering the mouth of the Columbia, wild salmon and steelhead, entering the mouth of the Columbia every year. And, you know, going up to the upper Columbia, up here, you know, in Spokane where I live, clear up into the Snake River Basin. And the Snake River Basin itself has always been historically one of the most productive salmon-producing parts of the entire Columbia Basin. Real productive habitat. And now, today, when you look at the whole basin, we have less than 1% of those wild populations remaining. You know, and in some cases, you've got Grand Coulee and all the habitat that's up there that has been, at least at this point, permanently cut off from fish being able to pass up there. You've got the Hell's Canyon Complex that has now stopped salmon that used to go, you know, well beyond Boise, Idaho, you know, clear down into southern Idaho, all in as far as Nevada. And we've lost a lot of those runs. But in the Snake River Basin, you know, we still had relatively healthy populations returning in the 1950s before some of the big dams were constructed and also the four lower Snake River dams constructed. And when those four dams went in from 1960 to 1975, we just saw the runs plummet. As each dam was built, the runs plummeted, the runs plummeted, the runs plummeted. And it was predicted. Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, as an example, fought really hard to stop that lower snake complex from happening because they knew exactly what it would do to the runs. And today, just to give you an idea, you know, I think we'll have a fraction of fish returning just up into talking about Idaho and about the Salmon River Basin. You know, I think we'll have 20,000 wild spring Chinook returning to the entire, you know, of Idaho's rivers up the Salmon River drainage. And what we need to even get to a point where we're recovering those runs is 80,000 wild fish returning. And so when you hear people say we have more fish coming back than since Bonneville Dam was built, or we're having the best runs ever, what they're including is all the hatchery fish that are being pumped into the system to provide fish for sport fishing, you know, fishermen to catch, for commercial fishermen to catch. They're not including those wild fish. And even the people who, in our coalition, who rely on hatchery fish for their livelihoods, all agree that we need to keep those wild fish. A hatchery fish does not equal a wild fish. We need those wild fish genetics, and we need to get them to levels where they can start restoring themselves. And in the last 12 years, we have not even come close to reaching those benchmarks of what we need to restore our fish.
So for those of you just joining us now, we're joined by Sam Mace, the Inland Northwest Project Director for the group Save Our Wild Salmon. And those are really some astonishing, eye-popping numbers that you throw out there, Sam. 30 million wild salmon populations used to enter the Columbia River Basin, and today we're about 1% of that. And then the other number that you threw out there, maybe 20,000 on a good year wild salmon will enter the Columbia Snake River basins there, and you said it's only about a quarter of what it needs to be for those populations to biologically recover, and you know, you brought up another good point. I think that might be the biggest misperception out there, and it's frustrating for me. I think it's frustrating for people that, you know, that are lovers of wildness, is that when you open up the newspapers these days, you know, the headlines of the articles talk about, oh, the fish runs are returning and the numbers are this and they're that much better than that. And there's barely any mention of the wild populations and how they are doing or how they may not be doing. And yet, for me, I feel like the mainstream media has really failed in educating the public about our responsibility, both economically, ecologically, and ethically, to restore wild populations, because they continue to write about, focus on, and mislead the public in hatchery fish populations.
Just to clarify, when I threw out that 20,000 number, I was talking about Snake River fish there. There's more than that that enters the Columbia today, but just trying to bring it down to a little more manageable, you know, just talking about the Snake River Basin. I think it's a complicated salmon restoration and salmon policy is really complicated with a long history. And so I think some of the complexities have a difficult time getting covered in the daily news. But one thing is clear, just to again reiterate the importance of protecting those wild fish and the importance of protecting specifically Snake River wild fish, is that whether you support hatcheries or you don't support hatcheries, I think we all should agree that it's important to hold on to those genetics of those wild fish. And our management strategies have to make sure that we're doing that. And in particular, as we're dealing with climate change and our river systems and the impacts that that's going to have on salmon populations, one of the interesting pieces that scientists have been talking about in terms of the Snake River fish is that these genetics of these fish are incredible. They travel farther and they spawn higher than any other salmon in the world, any other wild salmon in the world. They climb up into the Sawtooth Mountains. They climb more than 6,000 feet. The wild sockeye spawn in redfish. These are strong, strong genetics. And as we're and they also go up and spawn in this habitat that remains today the single biggest chunk of relatively pristine habitat left in the lower 48 for salmon. So you've got the connectivity, you've got these incredible ecosystems up in the Salmon River drainage, the Frank Church, and these incredible fish, a handful of which still make it up into these places. And their habitat up there, because it is higher elevation, is going to stay cooler longer in a warming world. And the more that we can do to protect those populations, protect the ecosystem connectivity up there, and make their path up into this incredible habitat just a little easier, the better shot we have of keeping salmon in a warming world. And perhaps as we start to deal with climate change, well beyond you and I are on this planet, perhaps those fish can also help repopulate areas downstream that may lose their salmon. We need to work on all rivers. This isn't saying one set of fish is more important than the other to protect, but certainly we should be doing what we can to protect those Snake River genetics, because they'll be very important in the future.
Well, Sam, that's really important, what you're talking about, and certainly here on the Wild Clearwater Country Show, and something that we're very proud of is the roadless base, is the habitat, the Clearwater Basin being the least developed watershed complex in the lower 48, or the fact that there's 9 million acres of roadless public wildlands plus big, large wilderness areas that offer this habitat that you can't find anywhere else. And like you said, with climate change upon us happening right now and things heading in the direction that they are, this habitat and like you're saying, getting them there, giving them that opportunity is so crucial right now. Now, wanted to talk a little bit about the Lower Four Snake River dams. You alluded to this earlier. A question that I wanted to ask you is with eight or nine dams on the main stem of the Columbia River, why is all the talk about decommissioning the Lower Four Snake River dams?
It's both environmental and economic. And I already talked about how important the habitat is in the Snake River Basin. So the reason that our coalition has focused on that Snake River Basin, although we work on, you know, salmon restoration, you know, our mission includes the whole Columbia Basin, is that that habitat that remains in the Snake River is so important and such high quality that it is a priority for the whole Columbia River Basin to get our fish back up into that that habitat. And that's one huge reason, as opposed to places, you know, there's up in the Columbia Basin, you know, up in the upper basin where I live, it's like we've lost. I mean, we have Grand Coulee in place, and it's a whole other challenge to talk about how you get salmon up past Grand Coulee, although there are people talking about that, versus trying to get, you know, salmon back up into the Snake. But the other piece as well is that it is important for our coalition as well that we not just be about restoring salmon, but that we also support a plan that takes care of and addresses the needs and interests of those other communities that right now are getting benefits from the dams, whether it's the farmers that rely on it to ship wheat down to Port of Portland, or it's the irrigators that irrigate right now off Ice Harbor Dam, or it's the energy users in the region that use the energy that does come off the four Lower Snake River dams. And one of the things about those four dams, though, is that the benefits that they provide compared to the four dams down on the Lower Columbia is quite small when you compare it to those other dams. They don't give us flood control. There's irrigation off one dam, aside from a few pumps off, you know, Lower Granite down there in Clarkston-Lewiston area. And those, that irrigation can continue by just putting the pipes down closer to the river, because they're not water storage dams. They provide less than, you know, 4% of the energy for the region. They're not big power producers, and they don't produce power when our region here in the Northwest needs it in the winter and the summer. Their primary purpose is transporting grain and other goods down the waterway. And so those we've looked at, and other independent entities have looked at, whether and how easy it is to replace the benefits of those dams. And it's definitely doable. We can live without the energy off those dams. We can keep the farmers at Ice Harbor, keep them in business if they want to stay in business. And there are lots of different ways that we can deal with the transportation question. You know, whether it's putting investments in rail, it's improving some of our highways. We could create a transportation system over here using a fraction of the money that we are spending on those dams, operation and maintenance, and trucking and barging fish around the dams, and build and invest in a transportation system here that would not just benefit the farmers, but benefit other businesses and other communities in our region. So that's the reason that we focus on the four dams. Snake River Basin has the best, biggest intact piece of habitat left in the Lower 48. And in terms of the economic benefits we're getting from those dams, they are replaceable.
Now, for those of you that are just tuning into the Wild Clearwater Country Show here on KRFP Moscow, we are joined by Sam Mace, who's the Inland Northwest Project Director for the group Save Our Wild Salmon. And Sam, I wanted to change gears here a little bit and talk about retired federal judge James Redden. Now, for some of our listeners that are able to read the paper or papers or might have saw the headlines maybe earlier this spring, I believe retired federal judge James Redden said, quote, "I think we need to take those dams down." And I was wondering if you could explain to our audience what exactly is a biological opinion and what has been the role of now retired federal judge James Redden. What role has he played over the last couple president administrations?
Well, a biological opinion, just in a nutshell, is a document that and a plan that the federal agencies develop to figure out how they're going to meet the requirements of the Endangered Species Act when a species is listed and considered in jeopardy. And so the Columbia Snake River Biological Opinion has been their plan on how they're going to meet the requirements of the Endangered Species Act and get us towards recovery. And so far, they have not produced a legal plan that gets us anywhere close to recovery or anywhere close to meeting the requirements of the Endangered Species Act or doing what the fish needs. And Judge James Redden has been a real honest and direct and fair judge over these administrations. And Judge Redden's personal history is really interesting. He actually has been around salmon politics and salmon legal issues since the 70s when he worked in the Attorney General's Office of the State of Oregon. So he came into this case already with a strong background in salmon issues and salmon politics and salmon law. And over the course of the four plans that he has reviewed and, well, maybe he had just three plans. Anyways, there's been four plans that have been put in front of the court, four biological opinions, all have been rejected as not meeting the requirements of the law. And Judge Redden gave the feds ample opportunity and ample time to come up with a viable, you know, a legal plan and a plan that would actually restore the fish. And so far they failed. But he has now retired, and the case has gone to another judge in the District of Portland. But I think Judge Redden he came out and said that in a media interview he was doing. And it was really great to hear his honest personal opinion. And clearly, with his expertise and his experience and his history, I think what he has to say carries some weight.
Yeah, absolutely. And to point out to our listeners here, Sam Mace with the group Save Our Wild Salmon just said that, you know, the four separate biological opinions have failed to meet the law. In other words, they've been declared illegal and insufficient. And those biological opinions have occurred under different presidential administrations. So whether it's Clinton or Bush or Bush again or Obama, what we have here is, you know, it's like Groundhog Day. It's the same old, I won't say the same old biological opinion, but it keeps failing to meet the law. So that's very frustrating, and beyond frustrating, it's killing the wild salmon and steelhead and other fish populations and even hatchery ones for that fact. So something's got to give here. Now, Sam, I wanted to give you the opportunity to share with our listeners what is Save Our Wild Salmon's vision for restoring wild salmon and steelhead populations in the Columbia and Snake River basins. I believe you have a couple programs geared towards this vision. Would you like to share that with us?
Yeah, certainly we don't want to be fighting in court for another two presidential administrations, you know, because holding the Fed's feet to the fire and forcing them to have to address the law and what the salmon really need is extremely important. But we, at some point, also need to bring everybody together and say, hey, how are we going to get out of the courtroom and figure out a plan that meets the law and helps us move forward here to restore these fish? And so what we've been calling for is a stakeholder process guided by the science and law, you know, still not backing away from the courts, but saying, hey, we recognize that there's a lot of issues around what happens with these dams and how we restore these fish that go beyond what's being discussed in that courtroom. And there's a lot of stakeholders and interests and people in the communities that aren't part of that court case. And, you know, the people of Lewiston who are looking at, you know, potential increased flooding risks caused by all the sediment that is piling up behind Lower Granite Dam and, you know, requiring them to either have to raise their levees or deal with more flood risk, those kind of interests and concerns are not being addressed in the court right now. You know, or if the future of those dams is for them to be removed, there's no discussions happening right now, right, on, okay, then what would that future transportation system look like? There's no entity or no process right now where those sort of conversations are happening. And those are, I think, are really important both for the salmon and for, obviously, our farmers, our energy users, the people of Lewiston, the people along the river communities all the way to Astoria. So what we've been pushing for and asking for is a stakeholder process that brings those interests together and has all the options on the table, you know, in terms of what do we need to do for these fish and what do we need to do for these communities. And let's look honestly at the economics and the costs, not just of taking those dams out, but the costs of keeping those dams, which are significant. And let's start moving forward rather than wasting taxpayer dollars on developing plans that never have a hope of meeting the muster of the law. And, you know, we just sit in court as our fish continue to edge closer to extinction. And it's not working for the region, it's not working for the fish. And so we hope, we have seen more support for such a process. We've been going out and talking to different people in the communities and stakeholders and others for such a process. And while none of our elected leaders in the region have yet stepped up and said yes, recently, now that's not entirely true, actually, I have to take that back. Both Senator Mike Crapo and Senator James Risch of Idaho have publicly called for a stakeholder process. And Senator Mike Crapo, this was a few years ago, called for a stakeholder process that had dam removal on the table. And so I have to actually say that the senators from the good state of Idaho have been more progressive in their public pronouncements than my own senators here in Washington State when it comes to, you know, calling for a stakeholder process. But that's what we're working for, and we remain hopeful that as we're looking at these other successful dam removals happening, you know, whether it's on the Elwha or it's on the Condit or, you know, it's the Marmot Dam on the Sandy River in Oregon or the Rogue River in Oregon, or all the dam removals happening around the country, that we're going to see some movement in the next 4 years. And if Obama gets elected, we think that we can move towards such a stakeholder process and see some sort of similar vision happen on the snake.
Now, for those of you just joining us, we're joined today by Sam Mace, Inland Northwest Project Director for the group Save Our Wild Salmon here on the Wild Clearwater Country Show. And Sam, I'm wondering if you could just give us, our listeners, a brief summary of the role that the Bonneville Power Administration, the BPA, What are they about, and why do they wield so much power over this issue?
Yeah, BPA. So Bonneville Power Administration was created in 1937 to market and distribute the power off the Bonneville Dam, the first dam built in the Columbia. And today they market and do all the transmission and the distribution of power from 31 hydro dams on the main stem and tributaries. They also have a nuclear power plant, and they've also got some coal and other interests that they feed into the system. And, you know, as the fish and environmental concerns were becoming a rising concern, there was passed in 1980 what's called the Northwest Power Act. It has a little longer title, but that's sort of what it's called, which called on and required Bonneville Power Administration to balance the needs of fish and power. And so the Northwest Power Planning and Conservation Council was created to do that, where, you know, it couldn't be, the river could not be just operated simply for power. It had to take in the concerns of salmon populations and other other environmental concerns into it. And I think it's clear that that mission of the Power Act has not really been met. and Bonneville Power Administration is an incredibly powerful agency because of the role they play in our power. They market and sell power to California. They wield tremendous political power here in the region. And they hold a lot of power with and are protected by our members of Congress out here. And in part that's because we got this special deal here in the Northwest with Bonneville Power Administration, where we pay some of the, if not the lowest power rates in the entire country. But part of that deal, of course, too, is that we protect salmon and the other, you know, fish and wildlife that are affected by the dams and the development along that river. And so our senators out here and our members of Congress are always very protective of BPA and that special power deal we have. And because of that, they are hard-pressed to ever call into question anything the BPA does. And so they've sort of been the kingmaker here in the region.
Yeah, exactly. Kingmaker. To me, that's the big domino. That's the one. If that domino can sway or even fall, topple, it appears that the political you know, what will occur politically, that's the linchpin, like you're saying, to possibly lead to true salmon, you know, and steelhead, you know, and just overall recovery of the river ecosystem. Sam, how about the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, also known as NOAA to a lot of people? What sort of role does this federal bureaucracy or agency play in all of this?
Yeah, that's the interesting, quirky thing regarding ocean-going salmon species, like our salmon and our steelhead, is that because they are anadromous and they go out to the ocean, rather than coming under the jurisdiction of the Fish and Wildlife Service, which most endangered species do, these salmon and our steelhead are under the purview of NOAA. And there's an agency within NOAA called NOAA Fisheries that is in charge of coming up with a biological opinion in conjunction with the other federal agencies and into the management of our anadromous fisheries. And it's somewhat frustrating. You know, it's unfortunate that our salmon and steelhead don't come under Fish and Wildlife Service, frankly. But it adds a whole other layer of bureaucracy, as you said, when we've got the Bonneville Power Administration marketing the power. We've got the U.S. Corps of Engineers that, you know, maintain, have built, and hopefully maybe will remove four of them, the dams, And then you've got NOAA Fisheries in charge of the salmon, and then, you know, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, of course, comes in for some of those other species that the dams affect, such as Pacific lamprey, such as sturgeon, such as other species. But it's very complicated.
Well, that was my next question there, is besides wild salmon and steelhead populations, what are some of the other species that have been pushed towards extinction because of the dams? I'm personally aware of the Pacific lamprey. Are there is the sturgeon or other species part of this larger picture and problem?
Sturgeon, the dams definitely affect sturgeon populations because they've basically genetically isolated these populations in the different reservoirs. And so, that is a big concern. The huge one, as you mentioned, is Pacific lamprey, which historically were a really important food source for the Native American tribes here in the region. The Nez Perce, certainly they were very important. And I think as of the last count, only 25 lamprey have made it past Lower Granite Dam this year. 25. And this used to be a major food source for the Nez Perce and other Indian tribes. And so there's those basic impacts. And then you have, of course, all the species that depend on salmon as a food source that are being affected. There's 35 fish, other species of fish and wildlife that depend on salmon for their food source, for key minerals and nutrients that they get from that are all affected when those salmon don't make it back to the systems. And some of those impacts of the loss of salmon into Idaho's ecosystems are only now just being studied and looking at what's happening long-term to those systems because we don't have the salmon returning. So it's these dams, they have a really big footprint in terms of the impacts that they cause and the ripple effects that sometimes takes us a long time to even recognize as happening.
Yeah. What a keystone species, if there ever was one. I think it, are wild salmon, steelhead, and because of just what you're talking about. This goes their impacts, their ripple effect, their trophic cascade, if you will, throughout an entire ecosystem, throughout an entire bioregion. I don't know if we've ever seen anything like it. And not only the significant role that they play within the river and its tributaries and along its riparian areas, but how it also affects the forests and the wildlife, the four-legged wildlife species and all the nutrients that it has delivered to these ecosystems and the benefits or cascade effect that it has on plant communities. It, like you're saying, it's something that we're just we're just starting to scratch the surface on. And I'm laughing because we think we know it all, from a species perspective. And we really have a lot to learn. And the role that salmon play, it's really astonishing. Not only their, and then when you include their physical attributes and their cultural importance, I don't know if there's another species like it on the whole planet. And that's no disrespect towards any other species, but just a spider web of impacts and synergy. Really, really amazing. It's horrible, that these wild populations are in the condition that they are in. For those of us that are listening here, we're joined today by Sam Mace, Inland Northwest Project Director for the group Save Our Wild Salmon. Sam, what we got, maybe another 5-6 minutes here and then we're going to let you go. A number of us have been paying close attention to this issue, and that's the proposed expansion of the Port of Lewiston. How does the proposed expansion of the Port of Lewiston fit into this very complicated jigsaw puzzle?
Well, I think it's a real waste of taxpayer dollars to be doing that expansion at Port of Lewiston when the future of the four lower Snake River dams remains in question. And I really think before more dollars are spent, which are so precious these days, federal dollars for our transportation needs, we really need to do a broader analysis of what our communities here in eastern Washington and north Idaho are going to need 30 years down the road. Is it a seaport in Idaho that's great for shipping soft white wheat but doesn't help some little manufacturer who might want to open a business in Wash Techna or Biola or wherever it is, you know? Or would our communities and our interests, as well as our farmers, be better served with a modern transportation system that relies on more on rail so that we can get goods not just down to Port of Portland, but to Port of Seattle, Puget Sound? Ports are becoming and are way more competitive than Port of Portland these days. Having a system that helps us get goods to the East Coast and helps move goods around our region, you know, in addition to getting stuff overseas. And we're not having that conversation right now, and so we're seeing money being thrown into, you know, a port expansion at Port of Lewiston rather than some really needed rail investments that would probably better serve our farmers long-term but also serve other businesses and manufacturers in the region. And so, yeah, I think it's unfortunate that they're trying to do that, and we should try to keep them from doing it.
Now, Sam, tonight, and this is pure irony, I take no credit, zero credit, for scheduling you to be interviewed today, along with the fact that Idaho Rivers United is giving a presentation in Moscow tonight with author Steve Hawley. And he's got a new book out called Recovering a Lost River, Removing Dams, Rewilding Salmon, and Revitalizing Communities. Tonight, that's here in Moscow at 7 p.m. at the Gambino's Italian Restaurant. And so I was wondering, have you read Steve Hawley's book? And are there any other books that you can recommend to our listeners when it comes to, this subject?
Yeah. Yes, I've read Steve Hawley's book. Highly recommend it. And highly recommend going and hearing him talk. He's a great speaker and a real advocate for the Snake River fish. On my short list, for those of you who want to explore this issue more, my three top books I would recommend is An Oldie But a Goodie by a local Pullman person, writer Keith Peterson, River of Life, Channel of Death, which is a specific history about the building of the Lower Snake River dams. Includes a lot of surprising history in it, that, you know, the fight to stop those dams from being built and the opposition that existed for those dams being built. It's an excellent history, kind of hard to find these days. I'm not sure if it's still in print, but copies are around. Salmon Without Rivers by Jim Likatowicz, which talks about the broader Pacific salmon crisis and talks a lot about hatcheries, for those of you who are interested in that issue. And he's a really renowned fisheries biologist here in the region. And then A River Lost by Blaine Harden, which deals more with the Columbia River, but it really captures the ideological divide that's happened between folks who love dams and folks who love salmon and the complexities. And he grew up in Moses Lake, and it's a really well-written book. And then for those of you who would rather watch a video or a movie, please Google Salmon Running the Gauntlet, the PBS Nature documentary done by Jim Norton that aired last year. Is one of the best synopsises of the crisis in 1 hour that I've ever seen. Highly recommend it. And you can also find it on our website, www.wildsalmon.org. And if people want other suggestions of books or anything, feel free to contact me, sam@wildsalmon.org. I can give you a whole bibliography.
Well, Sam, it has been an absolute treat to sit here on the other side of this telephone, so to speak, and learn from you. I certainly have a ton of respect for all of your hard work and dedication over the years and hopefully into the future here to not only restore wild salmon and steelhead populations, but to also revitalize our communities and to empower our cultures and our history and our heritage. And I want to thank you so much for being a guest here on the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Really looking forward to seeing Steve Hawley tonight and picking up a copy of that book. Please, one more time, why don't you plug the Save Our Wild Salmon website and how folks can get more involved in this very, very urgent issue.
You can sign up for alerts and get all kinds of up-to-date information at our website, wildsalmon.org. And people are also welcome to contact me, sam@wildsalmon.org, and I can certainly help let you know about events and opportunities right here in Eastern Washington and North Idaho. I will also say a plug for our campaign partners, Idaho Rivers United, they also have lots of opportunities for people to get involved, and as well as Friends of the Clearwater. Which you guys always get the word out on stuff, too.
Well, Sam, again, thank you so much for being a guest. And please do stay in touch and keep up the great work. We really appreciate everything you're doing.
Hey, you guys, too. Thanks.
All right, there you go. Sam Mace, the Inland Northwest Project Director for the group Save Our Wild Salmon. I mean, what a well-spoken individual, just tremendous understanding and ability to communicate to us, me, our listeners, a very complicated, incredibly complicated issue. If you think the wolves and what's going on with the wolf slaughter right now is complicated, and boy, it's taken me a couple years to wrap my head around that burrito. This one is just a gigantic whopper. I mean, what a juggernaut of an issue. And so, Sam, great job. Save Our Wild Salmon again. Check them out. They're a coalition, and so they're made up of a number of different interests, and so we applaud them for all of their work. And what a great radio program today. You've been listening to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Want to remind everyone that the views expressed in the Wild Clearwater Country Show are those of the individuals speaking during the show and not necessarily those of KRFP Moscow or any other organizations. Now, let's take a look at the weather here and start heading down the road. Tonight, clear with low around 39, winds out of the east around 5 miles an hour. Tomorrow, sunny with a high near 81. Thursday night, mostly clear with low around 43. Friday, sunny with a high near 84. Friday night, mostly clear with low around 48. Saturday, sunny with a high near 78. Saturday night, mostly clear with low around 45. Sunday, sunny with a high near 78 also. Sunday night, mostly clear with low around 43. Everyone have a great weekend. You've been listening to KRFP Moscow.
KRFP thanks its donors and underwriters, including
Mikey's Gyros, specializing in Greek and Middle Eastern cuisine such as gyros, falafel, hummus, tabbouleh, and spanakopita, located at 527 South Main Street in Moscow.
You are listening to KRFP Moscow.
We are now no longer the knights who say, Nikki. We are now the knights who say,
KRFP Moscow.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus, who separates the rhetoric from the reality of Barack Obama's foreign policy over the last 3.5 years. Author and activist Kevin Gray who examines President Obama and the Democratic Party's aversion to confronting the nation's rising level of poverty, and Bill Dusing of the Connecticut Northeast Organic Farming Association, who takes a critical look at a recent Stanford University study that questions the nutritional benefit of organic foods. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Cheap Chinese-manufactured arms, such as assault rifles and ammunition, have flooded conflict zones in sub-Saharan Africa, while Chinese diplomats work to undercut United Nations arms embargoes in nations such as the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Among arms exporters to Africa, China has been the most aggressive in challenging UN authority to monitor and restrict arms